joking last night that since we have a professor of fashion here, we would set up a catwalk for the impromptu fashion show, but I'm not going to do that. I wanted to start out a little bit talking about the Olympics. I was on a panel a few weeks ago with Chris Rudge, who's the CEO of the Canadian Olympic Committee at the University of Toronto, actually. Quite an interesting group assembled to talk about the history of politics and resistance in sports, and a lot of very interesting academic presentations, etc. This panel was on current Olympic issues, and he made an interesting comment when he started his talk about the danger of issue groups, various groups with their own agendas, hijacking the Olympics for their own issues. And it stuck with me at the time, and I made a comment on it because I realized that, in a sense, that is the history of the Olympics. There's always issues attached to the Olympics. It's not something which comes in from the outside. It's part of what happens with the Olympics whenever they come to a town. And one which seems to always fall under the radar, one group that has attached itself to the Olympics and has an agenda outside of the Olympics itself is the sportswear industry. In fact, the sportswear industry uses the Olympics and, of course, other major sporting events like the Euro Cup, which is on right now, as a major marketing opportunity. And for obvious reasons. I mean, the Beijing Olympics alone will bring something like a cumulative audience of 40 billion eyes to those screens watching that, watching those games. And that's a great audience for sportswear advertising. It's also an opportunity, of course, to associate your brand with the Olympic values and with sporting values, with those kinds of positive messages about lifestyle, which, of course, hopefully, from a sportswear perspective, encourage people to go out and buy those products and get fit. And certainly it's helping the fitness of the companies. During the last Athens Olympics, just before and just after, they measured the share prices of some of the major sporting brands, and we can say for sure that those Olympics were fairly helpful for the share price of Nike, for example, who recorded a 14.7% jump in share price between the three months before the Olympics and 3 months after. Now, of course, that does come without a cost for the companies. We look at the sponsorship of the Beijing Olympics, and Adidas, although the figures are private, the numbers probably run between $80 and $100 million for the sponsorship that Adidas has spent on sponsorship of the Beijing Olympics. It's a hefty price tag, but it's well worth it, I would say, because of the association, not only for the international community, but also because it helps to get the brand into China, even more so, to build a brand in China. So, what I'm trying to say is we're starting out from the grounds where the Olympics are already a point at which these issues are being brought in by the very presence of the major sporting brands, the sporting goods brands, which are sponsoring and licensing the Olympic brand. So, where do we come in? I want to maybe start today, since I'm the first one up, talking a little bit about working conditions, because I think we need to start by being grounded in what the actual problems are in those factories that we're trying to address. What is the reality for workers making sporting goods? What is the reality for workers making Olympic licensed goods? And there's two pieces of research I want to draw upon. One was conducted by the Playfair Olympics campaign just recently, and we put together a report which was profiling the sporting goods industry, some of the key issues which we saw as being problems for workers. We interviewed over 320 workers in factories around the world, primarily in China, India, Indonesia, and Thailand, which were chosen for very specific reasons, mostly because they're very prominent in the footwear industry, but also because they're, as you know, China, of course, is a major country, a sourcing country for most of the apparel companies producing for Canada. We not only did the interviews, but also reviewed all sorts of audit reports, published reports and unpublished reports, articles, newspaper accounts, and, of course, various things like factory advertisements and things like that, to put together a solid picture of what was happening in the industry. And the general findings from that report were sobering for anyone who's trying to work in the idea of corporate social responsibility. The general finding, of course, in one sentence is that even after 15 years of codes of conduct and auditing and those kinds of programs, the situation is still very bleak for workers. We're finding low wages, poverty wages, harassment and abuse, health and safety threats, excessive and often unpaid overtime or even unrecorded overtime. In short, sweatshop labor conditions. The very problems with all these codes of conduct and auditing programs were set up to ameliorate. So we decided, well, let's not just focus on what are the general problems which we find, but let's try to focus on a few core areas which might give us some kind of, if we could address those four core areas, might actually give us a bit of a boost to solving all these other problems that are faced in the industry. So we focused on four ones, which you see there. First one is freedom of association and collective bargaining. And the reason we focused here first is because not only is that a right for workers in and of itself, but it's also what they call an enabling right. That is, if you manage to allow unions in a factory, allow that kind of worker self-organization, it means that workers have the power to change the situation themselves. They don't need a code of conduct. They don't need an international brand auditing. They have the power to do something about it at the factory level. The second one, which we focused on, which relates to the first, is the issue of precarious employment. We found a pattern that there's an increasing flexibilization of labor in the sportswear industry and in the apparel industry generally, where workers are being hired more and more on short-term contracts or on no contracts at all, let go at the drop of a hat. And that's, first of all, that's not even a good business practice, but secondly, it means that there's a real structural impediment to the idea of being able to organize as a workforce when your workers may not be there the next month. So we wanted to address that issue. A more dramatic example of almost the same kind of thing is the issue of factory closures. That is where an entire factory is let go from day to day, where production shifts, where the owners of the factory shift production or the brands shift production so that a factory isn't able to sustain itself over the long term and the factory closes. And what we've been finding there, of course, is that this is having a dramatic impact not only in workers and the communities, but it's also meant some instability and some impacts on the ability, again, to organize. One obvious reason, of course, if you organize a factory and it's going to shut down the next day, the lesson to workers is don't organize. And of course, the last one we can't avoid is the question of living wages. This has been a problem from the get-go, but it's also become an increasing problem in recent months. As you know about the food price crisis, which is gripping half the world, this has become even more prominent and more of an issue because workers who are already on the margins and barely able to get by with the wages they're paid now have no safety net whatsoever. So I'm just going to take a quick look at some of these in a little bit more detail. First one, freedom of association and collective bargaining. I titled this Crushing Unions because I think that has often been the what has been happening in factories around the world, where workers try to organize. First, one of the responses we saw in many factories is that the union leaders are harassed. They're moved. We had one factory producing soccer balls where the union leader was put in a separate room by herself for 2 years to work completely isolated. The factory was, their reasoning for doing this was that she was working on top secret work for the company, and very important stuff that had to be done in isolation, which is an interesting thing to do to a union leader that you don't trust in any which way. But she eventually, of course, was led to leave the company. But that's not the worst situation. We look at other situations in the Philippines or Cambodia where union leaders have been harassed, been executed, threatened, where being a union leader is actually a threat to your life. Of course, even where unions do persist and manage to be organized in these dire conditions, there, even then, the management of the factory may not even agree to meet with the union or negotiate with the union. And this is something we face in many of the factories we're working with now, where there is no such thing as collective bargaining because the management won't even recognize the union, despite being a legal obligation. Where that doesn't succeed, often a unionized facility, once it finally gets to the point of having a representative for the workers, the whole facility will shut down. Where management or the owners are so determined to keep unions out of their companies, they will be willing to shut the entire factory down and move somewhere else just to avoid the presence of a union. Now, that's not the only piece of that. Sometimes we get situations where international buyers will also shift orders from factories which have successfully organized to factories where there is no union or to countries where the where unions are actually legally restricted. Again, China or Vietnam comes to mind. And that is, again, a pattern we've seen. It's not something being done by every company in every instance, but it is something where even the best efforts to try to organize in this industry have been stymied by this kind of practice. Now, turning to the question of precarious employment, it's fairly simple. With what we have here is an industry which is quite unstable. We have orders which shift from factory to factory, from country to country, by international buyers. You have, in that case, a factory which can't depend day-to-day on a steady stream of work, or you have a factory which relies on a kind of work which is seasonal in production. So you'll get in the winter months or the summer months, whatever the schedule may be, a lot of production, a lot of workers needed, but then a low season where they don't need workers, they don't have the orders coming in. And this has led to a pattern of flexibilization where workers are brought in for short terms and let go again. It's also been recorded, and this has happened a lot in China, where the factories have started using third-party contracting agencies. So outsourcing the actual employment to a third party, which employs the workers, and they only contract them for a short period of time. So that's been an increasing problem in the industry which we need to deal with. Lastly, of course, this, as I said, has had an effect on the ability for any workers to organize. In some places, it's been improved. We have seen some situations where companies, and here I'll point to a factory which I know one person here has been to visit, maybe two, where Adidas actually did some work to improve. Most of the factory was on short-term contract labor, and Adidas actually stepped in, and now I'd say probably the vast majority, if not all, are on full-time contracts. So there is an ability here to change that situation, which we want to see improve, or see spread across the supply chain. Now, as I said, one of the bigger problems we've got is industry destruction, which has led to factory closures. When a factory closes, it has a huge impact on the community. But on the workers themselves, we found that the vast majority of closures which we have witnessed and been involved in working with the people on the ground, the basic legal minimums are not being met. That is, workers are not getting the severance pay. They're not getting back wages. They're not getting health coverage which they're owed. And so it's having even more of an impact than it should. And we've been trying to work with companies and international brands to try to find ways to ensure that those payments are made, that at least, at the very least, the bare minimum is being paid to workers when those factories close. But as I said, the factory closure issue in itself is a problem which we have to address, that kind of constant shifting of production from place to place, because in that instance, there's very little possibility to organize. We were just involved in a factory in Mexico, which the day after the union won a vote against incredible odds. They won a vote for an independent union, and right after that, the factory closed, never to reopen. That's not an uncommon case. That's quite common. And lastly, I just want to turn to living wages as the obvious point I said earlier is that workers are not being paid. They're being paid poverty wages, but I don't think we have an appreciation for just how bad that can be. It's been interesting. A couple of years ago in Bangladesh, there was massive worker protests which by garment workers who were getting paid so little that they couldn't survive on those wages. Massive protests in the streets. They led to a process in which the wages were increased, finally, first time since 1994. And that's a great improvement, you'd think, except that when you look at the actual value of those wages, they're now worth even less than wages were in 1994, even after the wage increase. That's not an isolated problem. We've found the same kind of problem in Indonesia and other countries. Soccer ball stitchers in Pakistan there, we're looking at them getting between 57 and 65 cents per ball. And that, of course, hasn't changed either in 6 years. The cost of living has gone up by 40% in the meantime. I'm sure you're all familiar with this when we talk about the $10 minimum wage campaign here in BC. We all know that the value of the wage doesn't go as far here either. It's an incredible burden on workers in a place where they're not really, even when you start with the wages they're getting now, those were already too low to survive on. And of course, the last example I've got there is footwear workers in China, and I want to talk a little bit more about that because we did a fair bit of research at factories producing footwear in China for a company called Yuyen, which is a major transnational manufacturer. Most people won't have heard of that, but I'll bet you that a good number of people in this room are wearing shoes made by Yuyen or have shoes made by them. one in six pair of athletic shoes are made by this company. Whether they're made for Adidas or from Nike or New Balance or Puma, all those companies are present in those factories. So we looked at those factories to see what we could find. And one of the factories looked at just making shoes for Adidas, who was an Olympic sponsor. We found that the one of the most interesting things was that the company had instituted high production targets and higher production targets. So the workers were working even more than they had been before, up to 4 hours overtime a day. There was verbal and physical abuse. Even where safety equipment was provided, workers often didn't use it because it slowed them down. And that was a problem we reported across the board. We also found a factory in China where the minimum wage had actually been raised again. But what the company had done in response to that was to raise the production targets, the quota of what you had to produce per day. And when you don't meet the target, you don't get the bonus, which is a big portion of the wages. So after the minimum wage was raised, workers weren't getting the production bonuses, and their wages were actually either the same or less than they had been before the minimum wage had gone up. To give you a sense of what this means in practical purposes, a pair of shoes, Adidas shoes in Shenzhen, where these shoes are made, cost between 600 yen and 1,200. That's about $86 to $170 US, which is about a month's income for a worker. Let me press the right button here. So I'm just going to move on quickly to the question of what we should be doing about that. We just did this report. We set out, rather than just talking about the problems, we set out a series of targets, 36 different points, things which we thought the industry could be doing, and set of targets for 2010 and 2012. What could be done by this point? How can we measure progress? And I'm not going to speak too much to that because I think Doug Miller will say more about that. I'm not going to skip ahead because I have very little time here. But I do want to talk about some of the things which the Olympic movement can do. First, in response to the question which has been put forward in the media quite recently, there's been a lot of argument made that the Olympic movement should be, or the Vancouver Olympics should be making sure that all the products are being bought in Canada. That, unfortunately, isn't really the answer we're looking at today. For one obvious reason, and that's that we can't guarantee the products made in Canada are really meeting the same kind of standards which we want to hold up for workers either. We found a number of factories. There was a CBC report in 2004 that found workers in Vancouver making $2 an hour, or workers in Toronto making even less than that on a piece rate. So the question isn't just where it's made, it's how it's made. And for that, we moved to an example which was set by some of the universities and by the city of Vancouver, and that is the ethical purchasing policy. As you know, the City of Vancouver has an ethical purchasing policy. The universities, SFU, has an ethical purchasing policy. UBC, University of Toronto, the province of Manitoba. So, of course, the next step was to get Vancouver to put something in place, which they've done. I'm going to let Ann Duffy describe that program in better terms than I can. We're quite pleased to see that there's a program like that. But there are problems. The first one, which Jim Sinclair pointed to, was transparency. And that is that unless we know where the goods are being made, it's very difficult to ensure that they're actually made in good conditions. Transparency is a wonderful thing for labor rights issues because it really leads to a lot of other improvements. We can look at that example in the footwear industry. Both Nike and Adidas have disclosed all of their factory locations, and they're also seen as having some of the best labor rights compliance programs in the industry for that reason. Not many others have followed suit yet. Levi's has done so, and they tell us that it's actually been a benefit for them because they're able to now collaborate with other brands that are in the same factories to improve conditions. For us, on the other side of that, the outside of that, transparency is incredibly important because it allows us to verify that conditions are what they say they are. One of the problems we found in the Chinese factories, which we had looked at and which has happened in other countries as well, is that workers are often coached to lie to the auditors. People have found a way to game the auditing system. They keep double books or triple books, one which shows what workers are actually getting paid, how many hours they're actually working, and one which the auditors get to see where everything's quite rosy. We had an example recently in a factory producing school uniforms where the turnover at the factory is maybe over 50% a year. and of workers, 50% a year. But the books showed the same 320 workers at this factory every year, day in, day out, working the same number of hours, day in, day out, which is kind of an obvious sign there was a problem there. Strangely enough, the auditors for the company hadn't found that problem. Took an independent audit to find that kind of problem and interviews with the workers. So that is something which we've warned Vancouver needs to be looked on the lookout for, is poor auditing. But more importantly, having a backup system. Factory locations being public is one of those backup systems where workers can then bring their problems to the attention of local human rights and labor rights organizations, which can then bring their problems to VANOC and make sure that sort of issue is being brought through to the Olympics without being brought out through the press. That's one of the other problems of the program. There is no third-party complaint system, which we believe needs is a crucial component of any kind of ethical purchasing law, some way to actually address the problems when they're discovered. As I mentioned, wage is a crucial issue, so of course the living wage clause should be in the code of conduct. We know it's not now, but of course if it's not now, it should be, and if it's not going to be in the Vancouver program, it should be in the London program and in the Canadian Olympic Committee program. So what's next for us? First of all, improve the Vancouver Buy Smart program. Those improvements can be made, they should be made. Secondly, after 2010, when the rights to the Olympic brand revert to the Canadian Olympic Committee, the Canadian Olympic Committee needs to adopt a similar program. So when it's licensing the Olympic name for the following years, it also makes sure that things are being produced under ethical conditions. And to that note, Chris Roach has made a verbal commitment to that. We hope that that will be something that they work on and we see it happen. Beyond the Canadian Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee needs to take action on this. I think Doug will speak more to that. And of course, the London Olympics need to do something on that level. So with that, I'm going to leave you with that base, and I guess we'll move on to Doug. Thank you.